Mr. Sponge's Sporting Tour by R. S. Surtees, Part 2 of Chapter 25. The peal at the bell had caused a suppressed commotion in the apartment. Buried in the luxurious depths of a well-cushioned low chair, Mr. Sponge sat, Mog in hand, with a toe cocked up, now dipping leisurely into his work, now whispering something sweet into Amelia's ear, who sat with her crochet work at his side, while Emily played the piano, and Mrs. Jollyford kept in the background, in the discreet way mothers do when there is a little business going on. The room was in that happy state of misty light that usually precedes the entrance of candles, a light that no one likes to call darkness, lest their eyes might be supposed to be failing. It is a convenient light, however, for a timid stranger, especially where there are not many footstools set to trip him up. An exemption, we grieve to say, not accorded to everyone. Though Mr. Spraggan was such a cool, impudent fellow with men, he was the most awkward, frightened wretch among ladies that ever was seen. His conversation consisted principally of coughing.
Hem, cough, yes, hm, ahem, cough, cough, the day, is a cough, cough, very, mum, cold.
But we will introduce him into our family circle.
Mr. Spraggan, exclaimed Spigot, in a tone equal to the one in which Jack had announced himself in the entrance. And forthwith there was such a stir in the twilight apartment, such suppressed exclamations of,
Mr. Spraggan, Mr. Spraggan, what can bring him here? Our travellers, creaking boots and radiant leathers, eclipsing the sombre habiliments of Mr. Spigot, Mrs. Jollyford quickly rose from her Pembroke writing-desk and proceeded to greet him.
My daughters, I think you know, Mr. Spraggan. Also, Mr. Sponge?
Mr. Spraggan, continued she, with a wave of her hand to where our hero was ensconced in his form, in case they should not have made each other's speaking acquaintance. The young ladies rose and curtsied prettily, while Mr. Sponge gave a sort of backward hitch of his head as he sat in his chair, as much as to say,
I know as much of Mr. Spraggan as I want.
Tell your master Mr. Spraggan is here, added Mrs. Jollyford to Spigot, as that worthy was leaving the room. It's a cold day, Mr. Spraggan. Won't you come near the fire? Continued Mrs. Jollyford, addressing our friend, who had come to a full stop just under the chandelier in the center of the room.
Thank you, ma'am, muttered Jack. I'm not, cold, thank you, mum.
His face and hands were purple notwithstanding.
How is my Lord Scamperdale? Asked Amelia,
who had a strong inclination to keep in with all parties.
My lord, and that's to say, my lady. I mean to say, my lord's pretty well, thank you,
stuttered Jack. Is he coming? Asked Amelia.
My lord's not well. No, I mean to say, my lord's gone to dine with his friend Lord Bubblyjock. I mean Barker.
Jack and Lord Scamperdale were so in the habit of calling his lordship by this nickname that Jack let it slip, or rather cough out, inadvertently. In due time, Spigot returned with
Master's compliments, and he was very sorry, but he was so unwell that he was quite unable to see anyone.
Oh, dear, exclaimed Mrs. Jollyford.
Poor Pa, lisped Amelia.
What a pity,
observed Mr. Sponge.
I must go and see him, observed Mrs. Jollyford, hurrying off.
Hope he's not much, damaged, observed Jack.
The old lady being thus got rid of, and Jollyford disposed of, apparently for the night, Mr. Spraggan felt more comfortable, and presently yielded to Amelia's entreaties to come near the fire and thaw himself. Spigot brought candles, and Mr. Sponge sat moodily in his chair, alternately studying Mogg's Cab Fares,
Old Bailey, Newgate Street,
to or from the Adelphi, the Terrace, 1 shilling 6 pence, Admiralty, 2 shillings, and so on, and hazarding promiscuous sidelong sorts of observations that might be taken up by Jack or not, as he liked. He seemed determined to pay Mr. Jack off for his out-of-door impudence. Amelia, on the other hand, seemed desirous of making up for her suitor's rudeness, and kept talking to Jack with an assiduity that perfectly astonished her sister, who had always heard her speak of him with the utmost abhorrence. Mrs. Jollyford found her husband in a desperate state of excitement, his influenza being greatly aggravated by Harry having returned very drunk, with the mare's knees desperately broken by a fall, as Harry hiccuped out, or by his throwing her down, as Jollyford declared. Horses fall with their masters, servants throw them down. What a happiness it is when people can send their servants on errands by coaches or railways, instead of being kept on the fidget all day, lest a 50-pound horse should be the price of a bodkin or a basket of fish. Amelia's condescension quite turned Jack's head, and when he went upstairs to dress, he squinted at his lordship's best clothes all neatly laid out for him on the bed, with inward satisfaction at having brought them.
"Dash me," said he, "I really think that girl has a fancy for me."
Then he examined himself minutely in the glass, brushed his whiskers up into a curve on his cheeks, the curves almost corresponding with the curve of his spectacles above. Then he gave his bristly, porcupine-shaped head a backward rub with a sort of thing like a scrubbing brush.
"If only I'd had the silver specs," thought he, "I should have done."
He then began to dress, an operation that ever and anon was interrupted by the outburst of volleys of smoke from the little spluttering, smoldering fire in the little shabby room Jollyford insisted on having him put into. Jack tried all things, opening the window and shutting the door, shutting the window and opening the door, but finding that instead of curing it, he only produced the different degrees of a comparison, bad, worse, worst, he at length shut both, and applied himself vigorously to dressing. He soon got into his stockings and pumps, also his black Saxony trousers. Then came a fine black-laced fringed cravat, and the damson-colored velvet waistcoat with the cut steel buttons.
"Dash me, but I look pretty well in this," said he,
eyeing first one side and then the other as he buttoned it. He then stuck a chaste and figured fine gold brooch with 2 pendant tassel drops set with turquoise and agates that he had abstracted from his lordship's dressing case into his, or rather his lordship's, finely worked shirt front, and crowned the toilet with his lordship's best new blue coat with velvet collar, silk facings, and the flat hat hunt button, a striding fox, with the letters FHH below.
"Who shall say Mr. Spraggan's not a gentleman?" said he,
as he perfumed one of his lordship's fine coroneted cambric handkerchiefs with lavender water. Scent, in Jack's opinion, was one of the criterions of a gentleman. Somehow Jack felt quite differently towards the house of Jollyford, and though he did not expect much pleasure in Mr. Sponge's company, he thought nevertheless that the ladies and he, Amelia and he, at least, would get on very well. Forgetting that he had come to eject Sponge on the score of insufficiency, he really began to think he might be a very desirable match for one of them himself.
"The Spraggans are a most respectable family," said he,
eyeing himself in the glass.
"If not very handsome, at all events very genteel," added he,
speaking of himself in particular. So saying, he adorned himself with his spectacles and set off to explore his way downstairs. After divers mistakes, he at length found himself in the drawing-room, where the rest of the party being assembled, they presently proceeded to dinner. Jack's amended costume did not produce any difference in Mr. Sponge's behavior, who treated him with the utmost indifference. In truth, Sponge had rather a large balance against Jack for his impudence to him in the field. Nevertheless, the fair Amelia continued her attentions, and talked of hunting, occasionally diverging into observations on Lord Scamperdale's fine riding and manly character and appearance, in the roundabout way ladies send their messages and compliments to their friends. The dinner was flat,
Jollyford had stopped the champagne tap, though the needle-case glasses stood to tantalize the party till about the time the beverage ought to have been flowing, when Spigot took them off. The flatness then became flatter. Nevertheless, Jack worked away in his usual carnivorous style and finished by paying his respects to all the sweets, jellies, and things in succession. He never got any of these, he said, at home, meaning at Lord Scamperdale's. Amelia thought, if she was my lady, he would not get any meat there either. At length, Jack finished, and having discussed cheese, porter, and red herrings, the cloth was drawn, and a hard-featured dessert, consisting principally of apples, followed. The wine having made a couple of melancholy circuits, the strained conversation about came to a full stop, and Spigot, having considerately placed the little round table, as if to keep the peace between them, the ladies left the male worthies to discuss their port and sherry together. Jack, according to Woodmanstern fashion, unbuttoned his waistcoat and stuck his legs out before him, an example that Mr. Sponge quickly followed, and each assumed an attitude that as good as said, "I don't care twopence for you." A dead silence then prevailed, interrupted only by the snap, snap, snapping of Jack's toothpick against his chair edge, when he was not busy exploring his mouth with it. It seemed to be a match which should keep silence longest. Jack sat squinting his eyes inside out at Sponge, while Sponge pretended to be occupied with the fire. The wine being with Sponge, and at length wanting some, he was constrained to make the first move by passing it over to Jack, who helped himself to port and sherry simultaneously, a glass of sherry after dinner, in Jack's opinion, denoting a gentleman. Having smacked his lips over that, he presently turned to the glass of port. He checked his hand in passing it to his mouth and bore the glass up to his nose.
"Corked, by Jove!" exclaimed he,
setting the glass down on the table with a thump of disgust. It is curious what unexpected turns things sometimes take in the world, and how completely whole trains of well-preconcerted plans are often turned aside by mere accidents such as this. If it hadn't been for the corked bottle of port, there is no saying but these two worthies would have held a Quakers' meeting without the spirit moving either of them.
"Corked, by Jove!" exclaimed Jack.
"It is," rejoined Sponge, smelling at his half-emptied glass.
"Better have another bottle," observed Jack.
"Certainly," replied Sponge, ringing the bell.
"Spigot, this wine's corked," observed
Sponge, as old Pomposo entered the room.
"Is it?"
said Spigot, with the most perfect innocence, though he knew it came out of the corked badge.
"I'll bring another bottle,"
added he, carrying it off as if he had a whole pipe at command, though in reality he had but another out. This, fortunately, was less corked than the first, and Jack, having given an approving smack of his great thick lips, Mr. Sponge took it on his judgment and gave a nod to Spigot, who forthwith took his departure.
"Old trick, that,"
observed Jack, with a shake of his head as Spigot shut the door.
"Is it?"
observes Mr. Sponge, taking up the observation, though in reality it was addressed to the fire.
"Noted for it,"
replied Jack, squinting at the sideboard, though he was staring intently at Sponge to see how he took it.
"Well, I thought we had a bottle with a queer smatch the other night," observed Sponge. "Old Blossom Nose corked half a dozen in succession one night," replied Jack.
He had corked three, but Jollyford had recorked them, and Spigot was now reproducing them to our friends. Although they had now got the ice broken and entered into something like a conversation, it nevertheless went on very slowly, and they seemed to weigh each word before it was uttered. Jack, too, had time to run his peculiar situation through his mind, and ponder on his mission from Lord Scamperdale, on his lordship's detestation of Mr. Sponge, his anxiety to get rid of him, his promised corner in his will, and his lordship's hint about buying Sponge's horses if he could not get rid of him in any other way. Sponge, on his part, was thinking if there was any possibility of turning Jack to account. It may seem strange to the uninitiated that there should be prospect of gain to a middleman in the matter of a horse deal, save in the legitimate trade of auctioneers and commission stable keepers. But we are sorry to say we have known men calling themselves gentlemen who have not thought it derogatory to accept a trifle for their good offices in the cause. "I can buy cheaper than you," they say, "and we may as well divide the trifle between us." That was Mr. Spraggan's principle, only that the word trifle inadequately conveys his opinion on the point. Jack's notion being that a man was entitled to 5 pounds per cent as of right, and as much more as he could get. It was not often that Jack got a bite at my lord, which perhaps made him think it the more incumbent on him not to miss an opportunity. Having been told, of course he knew exactly the style of man he had to deal with in Mr. Sponge, a style of men of whom there is never any difficulty in asking if they will sell their horses, price being the only consideration. They are indeed a sort of unlicensed horse dealers, from whose presence few hunts are wholly free. Mr. Spraggan thought if he could get Sponge to make it worth his while to get my lord to buy his horses, the whatever he might get would come in very comfortably to pay his Christmas bills. By the time the bottle drew to a close, our friends were rather better friends, and seemed more inclined to fraternize. Jack had the advantage of Sponge, for he could stare, or rather squint, at him, without Sponge knowing it. The pint of wine apiece, at least as near a pint apiece as Spigot could afford to let them have, somewhat strung Jack's nerves as well as his eyes, and he began to show more of the pupils and less of the whites than he did. He buzzed the bottle with such hearty goodwill as settled the fate of another, which Sponge rang for as a matter of course. There was but the rejected one, which, however, Spigot put into a different decanter, and brought it in with such an air as precluded either of them saying a word in disparagement of it.
"Where are the hounds next week?" asked Sponge, sipping away at it. "Monday, Lark Hall Hill. Tuesday, the crossroads by Dollington Burn. Thursday, the toll bar at Whitborough Green. Saturday, the kennels," replied Jack. "Good places?" asked Sponge. "Monday's good," replied Jack. "Draw Thorny Gorse. Sure find. Second draw, Barnlow Woods, and home by Loxley, Padmore, and so on." "What sort of place is Tuesday?"
"Tuesday?" repeated Jack.
"Tuesday.
Oh, that's the crossroads. Capital place, unless the fox takes to Rumborough Crags, or gets into Seedywood Forest, when there's an end of it. At least, an end of everything except pulling one's horse's legs off in the stiff clay rides. It's a long way from here, though," observed Jack.
"How far?" asked Sponge. "Good 20 miles, replied Jack. "It's 16 from us. It'll be a good deal more from here."
"His lordship will lay out overnight, then?" observed Sponge.
"Not he," replied Jack. "Takes better care of his sixpences than that. Up in the dark, breakfast by candlelight, grope our ways to the stable, and blunder along the deep lanes and through all the by-roads in the country. Get there somehow or another."
"Keen hand," observed Sponge.
"Mad," replied Jack.
They then paid their mutual respects to the port.
"He hunts there on Tuesdays," observed Jack, setting down his glass, "so that he may have all Wednesday to get home in, and be sure of appearing on Thursday. There's no saying where he may finish with a crossroads meet."
By the time the worthies had finished the bottle, they had got a certain way into each other's confidence. The hint Lord Scamperdale had given about buying Sponge's horses still occupied Jack's mind. And the more he considered the subject and the worth of a corner in his lordship's will, the more sensible he became of the truth of the old adage that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
"My lord," thought Jack, "promises fair, but it is but a chance, and a remote one. He may live many years, as long, perhaps longer, as me. Indeed, he puts me on horses that are anything but calculated to promote longevity. Then he may marry a wife who may eject me, as some wives do eject their husband's agreeable friends. Or he may change his mind and leave me nothing after all."
All things considered, Jack came to the conclusion that he should not be doing himself justice if he did not take advantage of such fair opportunities as chance placed in his way, and therefore he thought he might as well be picking up a penny during his lordship's life as be waiting for a contingency that might never occur. Mr. Jollyford's indisposition preventing Jack making the announcement he was sent to do made it incumbent on him, as he argued, to see what could be done with the alternative his lordship had proposed, namely, buying Sponge's horses. At least, Jack salved his conscience over with the old plea of duty, and had come to that conclusion as he again helped himself to the last glass in the bottle.
"Would you like a little claret?" asked Sponge, with all the hospitality of a host. "No, hang your claret," replied Jack. "A little brandy, perhaps?" suggested Sponge. "I shouldn't mind a glass of brandy," replied Jack, "by way of a nightcap."
Spigot, at this moment entering to announce tea and coffee, was interrupted in his oration by Sponge demanding some brandy.
"Sorry," replied Spigot, pretending to be quite taken by surprise. "Very sorry, sir. But, sir, master, sir, bed, sir, disturb him, sir."
"Oh, dash it, never mind that," exclaimed Jack. "Tell him Mr. Spraggin,
the bottle of port beginning to make Jack rather inarticulate.
"Tell him Mr. Spraggin wants a little."
"Dursn't disturb him, sir," responded
Spigot with a shake of his head.
"Much as my place, sir, is worth, sir."
"Haven't you a little drop in your pantry, think you?" asked Sponge.
"The cook, perhaps, has," replied
Mr. Spigot, as if it was quite out of his line.
"Well, go and ask her," said Sponge,
"and bring some hot water and things, the same as we had last night, you know." Mr. Spigot retired and presently returned, bearing a tray with 3/4 of a bottle of brandy, which he impressed upon their minds was
the cook's own.
"Oh, I dare say," hiccuped Jack, holding the bottle up to his light.
"Hope she wasn't using it herself," observed Sponge. "Tell her we'll her health,"
hiccuped Jack, pouring a liberal potation into his tumbler.
"That'll be all you'll do, I dare say,"
muttered Sponge to himself as he sauntered back to his pantry.
"Does Jaw stand smoking?"
asked Jack as Spigot disappeared.
"Oh, I should think so," replied Sponge. "A friend like you, I'm sure, would be welcome,"
Sponge thinking to indulge in a cigar and lay the blame on Jack.
"Well, if you think so," said Jack,
pulling out his cigar case, or rather his lordship's, and staggering to the chimney piece for a match, though there was a candle at his elbow.
"I'll have a pipe."
"So'll I," said Sponge, "if you'll give me a cigar."
"Much yours is mine,"
replied Jack, handing him his lordship's richly embroidered case with coronets and ciphers on either side, the gift of one of the many would-be Lady Scamperdales.
"Want a light?"
hiccuped Jack, who had now got a glowworm end to his.
"Thanks,"
said Sponge, availing himself of the friendly overture. Our friends now whiffed and puffed away together. Whiffing and puffing were whiffing and puffing had never been known before. The brandy began to disappear pretty quickly. It was better than the wine.
"That's a nicest horse of yours," stammered Jack as he mixed himself a second tumbler.
"Which?" asked Sponge.
"The brown," spluttered Jack.
"He is that," replied Sponge. "Best horse in this country by far."
"The chestnut's not a bad one, I dare say," observed Jack.
"No, he's not," replied Sponge. "A deuced good un."
"I know a man who's rather sweet on the brown," observed Jack, squinting frightfully.
Sponge sat silent for a few seconds, pretending to be wrapped up in his sublime tobacco.
"Is he a buyer or just a jar?" he asked at last.
Oh, a buyer, replied Jack.
I'll sell, said Sponge, with a strong emphasis on the sell.
How much?
Asked Jack, sobering with the excitement.
Which? Asked Sponge.
The brown, rejoined Jack.
300, said Sponge. I gave 2 for him.
Indeed, said Jack. A long pause then ensued, Jack thinking whether he should put the question boldly as to what Sponge would give him for effecting a sale, or if he should beat about the bush a little. At last he thought it would be most prudent to beat about the bush and see if Sponge would make an offer.
Well, said Jack, I'll see what I can do.
That's a good fellow, said Sponge, adding, I'll remember you if you do.
I dare say I can sell them both, for that matter,
observed Jack, encouraged by the promise.
Well, replied Sponge, I'll take the same for the chestnut. There isn't the toss-up of a halfpenny for choice between them.
Well, said Jack, we'll see them next week.
Just so, said Sponge.
You ride well up to the hounds, and let his lordship see what they can do, continued Jack.
I will, said Sponge, wishing he was at work.
Never mind his rowing, observed Jack. He can't help it.
Not I, replied Sponge, puffing away at his cigar.
When men once begin to drink brandy and water after wine, there's an end of all note of time. Our friends, for we may now call them so, sat sip, sip, sipping, mix, mix, mixing, now strengthening, now weakening, now warming, now flavoring, until they had not only finished the hot water, but a large jug of cold that graced the center of the table between 2 frosted tumblers, and had nearly got through the brandy, too.
"May as well finish the bottle,"
observed Jack, holding it up to the candle.
"Just a thimbleful apiece," added he,
helping himself to about 3/4 of what there was.
"You've taken your share,"
observed Sponge, as the bottle suspended payment before he got half the quantity that Jack had.
"We'll squeeze it," replied Jack,
suiting the action to the word, and working away at an exhausted lemon. At length, they finished.
"Well, I suppose we may as well go and have some tea," observed Jack.
"It's not announced yet," said Sponge, "but I make no doubt it will be ready."
So saying, the worthies rose, and after sundry bumps and certain irregularities of course, they each succeeded in reaching the door. The passage lamp had died out, and filled the corridor with its fragrance. Sponge, however, knew the way, and the darkness favored the adjustment of cravats and fingering of hair. Having got up a sort of drunken simper, Sponge opened the drawing-room door, expecting to find smiling ladies in a blaze of light. All, however, was darkness, save the expiring embers in the grate. The tick-tick-ticking of the clocks sounded wonderfully clear.
"Gone to bed!" exclaimed Sponge.
"Whoop!" shrieked Jack at the top of his voice.
"What's matter, gentlemen? What's matter?"
exclaimed Spigot, rushing in, rubbing his eyes with one hand and holding a block tin candlestick in the other.
"Nothing," replied Jack, squinting his eyes inside out, adding, "Get me a deviled..."
"Don't know how to do them here, sir,"
snapped Spigot.
"Deviled turkey leg, though you do, you rascal,"
rejoined Jack, doubling his fists and putting himself in posture.
"Beg pardon, sir," replied Spigot,
"but the cook, sir, is gone to bed, sir. Do you know, sir, what o'clock it is, sir?"
"No," replied Jack.
"What time is it?" asked Sponge.
2:40,
replied Spigot, holding up a sort of pocket warming pan, which he called a watch.
"The deuce!" exclaimed Sponge.
"Who'd have thought it?"
muttered Jack.
"Well, then, I suppose we may as well go to bed," observed Sponge.
"Suppose so," replied Jack. "Nothing more to get."
"Do you know your room?" asked Sponge.
"To be sure I do," replied Jack. "Don't think I'm drunk, do you?"
"Not likely," rejoined Sponge.
Jack then commenced a very crab-like ascent of the stairs, which fortunately were easy, or he would never have got up. Mr. Sponge, who still occupied the state apartments, took leave of Jack at his own door, and Jack went bumping and blundering on in search of the branch passage leading to his piggery. He found the green baize door that usually distinguishes the entrance to these secondary suites, and was presently lurching along its contracted passage. As luck would have it, however, he got into his host's dressing-room, where that worthy slept, and when Jollyford jumped up in the morning, as was his wont, to see what sort of day it was, he trod on Jack's face, who had fallen down in his clothes alongside of the bed, and Jollyford broke Jack's spectacles across the bridge of his nose.
"Rot it!" roared Jack, jumping up. "Don't ride over a fellow that way!"
When, shaking himself to try whether any limbs were broken, he found he was in his dress clothes instead of in the roomy garments of the Flat Hat Hunt.
"Who are you? Where am I? What the deuce do you mean by breaking my specs?" he exclaimed, squinting frightfully at his hosts.
"My dear sir," exclaimed Mr. Jollyford from the top of his nightshirt, "I'm very sorry, but—"
"Hang your butts! You shouldn't ride so near a man," exclaimed Jack, gathering up the fragments of his spectacles,
when, recollecting himself, he finished by saying,
"Perhaps I'd better go to my own room."
"Perhaps you had," replied Mr. Jollyford, advancing towards the door to show him the way.
"Let me have a candle," said Jack, preparing to follow.
"Candle, my dear fellow? Why, it's broad daylight," replied his host.
"Is it?"
said Jack, apparently unconscious of the fact.
"What's the hour?"
7:55, replied Jollyford, looking at a timepiece. When Jack got into his own den, he threw himself into an old invalid chair and sat rubbing the fractured spectacles together as if he thought they would unite by friction, though in reality he was endeavoring to run the overnight's proceedings through his mind. The more he thought of Amelia's winning ways, the more satisfied he was that he had made an impression, and then the more vexed he was at having his spectacles broken. For though he considered himself very presentable without them, still he could not but feel that they were a desirable addition. Then, too, he had a splitting headache, and finding that breakfast was not till 10 and might be a good deal later, all things considered, he determined to be off and follow up his success under more favorable auspices. Considering that all the clothes he had with him were his lordship's, he thought it immaterial which he went home in. So, to save trouble, he just wrapped himself up in his mackintosh and travelled in the dress ones he had on. It was fortunate for Mr. Sponge that he went, for when Jollyford smelt the indignity that had been offered to his dining-room, he broke out in such a torrent of indignation as would have been extremely unpleasant if there had not been someone to lay the blame on. Indeed, he was not particularly gracious to Mr. Sponge as it was. But that arose as much from certain dark hints that had worked their way from the servants' hall into my lady's chamber, as to our friend's pecuniary resources and prospects. Jollyford began to suspect that Sponge might not be quite the great catch he was represented. Beyond, however, putting a few searching questions, which Mr. Sponge skillfully parried, advising his daughters to be cautious, lessening the number of lights, and lowering the scale of his entertainments generally, Mr. Jollyford did not take any decided step on the matter. Mr. Spraggan comforted Lord Scamperdale with the assurance that Amelia had no idea of Sponge, who he made no doubt would be very soon out of the country. And his lordship went to church and prayed most devoutly for him to go. End of chapter 25.